Welcome to Counterpoint. I'm Jonathan Judaikin. Tom Rankin writes in his foreword to William Ferris's new book, The South in Color, a series of photographs like these help us to see with fresh eyes where we've already been, help us to remember, yes, but also prompt us to discover a new clarity of vision, a way to reimagine even the most familiar of past places. The joy of this work is the deeply considered reflection, a series of powerful images that bear witness to the range of places, people, and moments Bill found resonant and relevant. This is the photographic work of a great listener and observer. Bill Ferris's images make us feel we are learning our own history yet again, while simultaneously discovering brand new territories we had no idea existed. As the author-editor of many books and at least 15 documentary films, Bill Ferris has long been helping us to reflect on Southern culture. He'll be at the Cottom Museum at 6 p.m. on October 8th to talk about and sign The South in Color. Bill Ferris, I'm so happy to have you with me today on Counterpoint. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Jonathan.
Bill, The South in Color opens with a beautiful dedication to your mother, set over a wonderful shot of your family farm that gives a clear sense of the world you grew up in and that inspired you to want to understand it by becoming a folklorist and documentarian. Tell us about that world southeast of Vicksburg, Mississippi.
Well, it's a pastoral rural world, very isolated. When I grew up, there were families of black people who had lived on that farm for generations, and my family who had moved there when my parents moved there. But we lived in a fairly insular world, and it was quite powerful. You became quickly aware of the people, their voices, the little church on the farm, the storytellers, my grandfather and others, the little country stores nearby. All of that was a world that really was my introduction to the South from the time I can remember. Those were people and places that shaped me in very deep and enduring ways.
And one of the things that runs across all of your work is the way in which people return to those kinds of places. Is it your sense that your farm was the South writ small, or was your family farm growing up an exception to the larger patterns that you've come to discover about the South working on it now for 50 years?
I think it was both of those, Jonathan. It was the South writ large in that there were white and black families living in intimate relationships in the rural world that we knew there. But it was also different because my parents were both educated progressives, and our extended family were involved with education, and we were exposed early on to all sorts of reading and people from the University of Chicago, where my uncle was the treasurer, from the University of Cincinnati, where another uncle was a leading scholar of medicine who worked closely with Jewish psychiatrists. And they brought those worlds to the farm on holidays, and they expanded our horizons in significant ways. It was almost like a salon of intellectual ferment that our family nurtured there. And as children, we grew up in those worlds, knowing that education was the most important thing in our lives, and that respect for people, both black and white, was an absolute essential in how we were supposed to act.
Now, The South in Color is the third in a trilogy that seeks to capture the South in a montage you've been working on in various forms for over 50 years that includes Give My Poor Heart Ease, Voices of the Mississippi Blues, published in 2009, and The Storied South, Voices of Writers and Artists from 2013. This is a fabulous triptych because the two early books also come with adjoining films and CDs, And together, all three weave this beautiful quilt of Southern culture. Give My Poor Heart Ease, the book about the blues, has its genesis, I believe, as one of the four films you made through the Media Design Studio when you were at Yale in the mid-1970s. Tell us a little bit more about that project and how it fed into the more recent book.
Well, the Media Design Studio at Yale was a very innovative effort led by a friend named Howard Weaver, who had been a classmate of Kingman Brewster, who was president of Yale. And Howard's vision was to create a cinematic counterpart to the Yale University Press for faculty who were interested in doing film as part of their academic career. And I fit that bill, and he was very excited about the idea of focusing four films on black folklore, one of which looked at the blues, and that is what Give My Poor Heart Ease was the lead film in. And that title for the film also became the title for the book that's the first of this trilogy.
That's so interesting. And one thing we'll do is include a link to your films at folkstreams.net on the WKNO website so that listeners can dive more deeply into not only that work, but into many of the films that you've made. Bill, we learn in The South in Color that you began making recordings and motion pictures in the 1960s that focused on storytellers, quilters, blues musicians, and in the 1970s on photographers, poets, writers, and scholars. You write in The Storied South that the South is a land of talkers whose stories are as old as the region itself. The story is the inescapable net that binds Southerners together. Southern writers translate the story into fiction. Scholars use the story to explain the region's history. Musicians transform the story into song. And photographers and painters capture the story in images. Through storytelling, the South reveals its soul. And in your interview in that book with Pete Seeger, he quotes Mahalia Jackson, who said that if you learn a little of somebody's language, then you learn a little bit of their soul. Is that really the goal with all of your work, to capture all the various kinds of languages of the South so that you can give us a glimpse of its soul?
Absolutely. I think of the spoken word as a form of music. Particularly in the South, the voices of people like Robert Penn Warren, Shelby Foote, Martin Luther King, Alice Walker, each voice has a kind of resonance of rhythm and power. And each of the speakers in my films and books, from prison inmates at Parchman Penitentiary to B.B. King to Eudora Welty, has a kind of power and beauty within their voice. And as a folklorist, I've always tried to unleash those voices and give them equal power and equal access to the public. Many of those voices are well known and famous. Others are totally unknown. But when they're all together, it's like a quilt with many colors or a gumbo with many flavors mixed together. It helps us get to the true soul of the American South.
So I'm wondering a little bit about that, because when we talk about the soul, or we use language like the sense that your work is capturing something authentic, it seems as if you would valorize that term, but are you skeptical at all about authenticity in kind of this age in which everything gets spun in a different way?
Well, I think authenticity is essentially honesty, and it's like the Mississippi River. At Memphis, you can never step into the same water twice. And what is authentic in one moment is constantly changing. It was my privilege to speak and visit with people in the 60s and 70s, to document with photography, film, and sound recordings their worlds. That was an authentic sound and image for that moment. Today, it's part of history. But authenticity is what we achieve when we come out with an honest heart and try to understand the people and the places in which they live in the American South.
So your example of sort of putting your foot into the Mississippi and it never being the same thing twice gets at the heart of this kind of contingency. But at the same time, you're binding these things together in a work that represents something. Let's drill into that a little deeper. Was the collection of those that you included in the Storied South just a matter of chance based on who you had interviewed? Or are you saying something about the people that you included that if you want to understand the South through its intellectual reflection, you need to understand its writers, scholars, musicians, photographers, and painters?
When I began this work, the field of Southern studies did not exist. I was simply a Southerner on a journey trying to understand my own experience, having grown up on a farm, and to make sense of that within the framework of the academy. And there were signposts along the way, the works of Alex Haley, of Eudora Welty, of Alice Walker, many of the people whose work I read or listened to, as in the case of Pete Seeger, or saw in the case of Carol Clore. Those were my heroes and heroines. And when I had a chance to meet them, I would always bring out my camera, tape recorder, and film, and record an interview with them because I knew they were important to me. And over the years, the field of Southern studies and the study of the American South has become a discipline. And it's built in many ways on the foundation of these great writers, scholars, artists, and musicians. So I see the Storied South as a foundational work for the whole field of Southern studies.
And I have to say, I mean, this trinity of works in general, listeners should just have this on their bookshelves because it is just a wonderful index into the whole quilt of Southern culture. But let's push this a little deeper. Musicians are set alongside writers and scholars in the Storied South, but that deals entirely with cultural icons. In The South in Color, the most recent book, the portraits are of ordinary folk, prison inmates, quilt makers, and roadside vendors. Why is it important for you to capture all of these different voices and images of the South?
Well, I like to tell my students an African proverb which says that when an old woman or man dies, a library burns to the ground. And it's in that sense that every person in the South is a living library. And sadly, most of those libraries are extinguished and lost when they die. But as a folklorist, I have tried to collect and honor and respect the lives of people whom I've known along my journey. So The South in Color offers portraits of these amazing people, pictures of their homes and communities, as a way of setting the stage, of giving you access to their worlds through color photography. And that work is deeply indebted to and inspired by the color photography of William Eggleston, an old friend whose work I have admired since we first met in the 70s.
That African proverb is just so powerful because if people would just live their lives conscious that they're a library, that would change the way people lived as well. If you're just tuning in, I'm Jonathan Judaikin, and you're listening to Counterpoint. I'm speaking to William Ferris about the latest in his trilogy of books, The South in Color, which he will lecture about and sign at the Cotton Museum on October 8th. Bill, if these books are an informal trilogy, how do they fit together for you?
Well, they fit together like pieces of a puzzle. Give My Poor Heart Ease is a true, heartfelt work of a folklorist going into Parchman Penitentiary, into the homes of people in Kent's Alley and Leland, Mississippi, and listening to their voices and their performances, and also to the great artists, B.B. King, whose work is really the consummate voice of the blues. All of those voices, male and female, many of which are in the church as well as in blues clubs, give us the frame for understanding country blues and the Mississippi Delta. The second book, The Storied South, leads into people who have taken those voices, white and black, and integrated them into their novels, their short stories, their poems, their music, their art. So they are people who have studied the South and transformed what we can think of as vernacular or folk voices and worlds into the academy, the literary and cultural tradition of the South. And the third volume, The South in Color, moves us from the stark black and white images of the first two books to the lavish, drenched color of the worlds of the people with whom I've worked. So each book is in many ways quite different from and complementary to the other two.
We've talked a little bit, Bill, about the role of storytelling, but race and racial violence, as we're seeing every day on our television screens and listening to on our radios, is another central strand, not only of the American story, but more particularly of Southern culture. How does race and racial violence fit into the trilogy that you've put together?
Racial violence is joined at the hip with everything that I have ever done as a folklorist and as a teacher. I have tried from my youngest memory to build bridges across the troubled waters of race that I've seen in the South. When I was a child, about 4 or 5 years old, a black lady named Mary Gordon took me to the little church on the farm where I grew up, Rose Hill Church, and taught me the hymns. And I realized that there were no hymnals in that church. And when those families were no longer there, the music would disappear. So I began to record and photograph and film those worlds as a way of making a pledge to those families that my life would not forget what they taught me at an early age. And at the age of 5, I got on a school bus and went to a little rural school where each teacher taught 2 grades, and all the students were white. My black friends on the farm went to a 1-room schoolhouse where 1 teacher taught 6 grades, and I knew in my heart that was wrong, and that was my first lesson of the injustice of the worlds into which I was born. And in the 60s, my siblings and I were involved with civil rights. We met with my father, with the leaders of Mississippi's Freedom Summer, with Robert Moses. And Moses looked across the table at my father as they were speaking and told him, "This is the first time I have ever had a civil conversation with a white Mississippian." And my work as a folklorist, and these 3 books are an example of it, are an effort to cast a wide net of understanding, of love, of compassion, as a way of building bridges between this terrible history of racism and violence, which sadly continues today.
And I guess you do that by sort of juxtaposing both white and black voices and artists together, and also what we sometimes take as high and low culture. So building these racial bridges, I want to ask you about another bridge, Bill, because in this book of photographs, you, I think, cross the bridge between documentarian and artist. Is there a line there for you between the two? I mean, do you think of yourself as an artist, because I think saying that would be slightly awkward for most of the rest of us who are in the academy.
Well, I think the highest achievement is art. And I've always looked up to writers and painters who are true artists. And I've always said to myself, to the degree that I can, I want my work to be a work of art. I want it to be rendered in careful, thoughtful ways as a narrative, as a photography narrative and text. And I see every one of us who works, you included, Jonathan, as a radio interviewer. There is an art to what you do. And for me as a folklorist, I do not consider myself an artist, but I certainly aspire to being an artist in terms of what I do.
I guess that's a little bit different now with these photographs that you had been taking. I suppose when you were initially taking them, you were just documenting your experience, but when you bind them together in this book, they become art. Would you say that that's true?
I think it is true. I think we don't understand a lot of what we do. We do it out of a sense of urgency, a sense of instant beauty that we want to capture, a sunset, a face. And we put those on the shelf and keep them there and come back to them later, in my case, many years later, and try to put them together and look for a pattern within them. And when I've done that in these three books, the patterns are things that I would not have seen when I actually took the photographs. And you try to weave it together again like a quilt. These are unlikely pieces that together form a powerful work of art that's far greater than any of the pieces that you made along the way.
Now, almost all the photographs in The South in Color were taken in the mid-1970s. What was key about that time that made you want to focus this book on photographs from that moment?
I'm a child of rock and roll. I grew up in the 50s listening to Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis, and I came of age also in the 60s with the civil rights movement, with Vietnam, all of these traumatic changes in the American South were part of my education. Without my knowing it, I was being changed by those worlds. And I felt that in my photography. I felt an urgency to document worlds that I felt were fragile and would change and be forgotten. And the people whom I photographed in The South in Color were part of that moment. And their faces, their expressions, the landscape and homes that they were part of, to me, were who I am and who I was. They were like looking in a mirror and seeing myself. And I felt that it was critical that color film be a way of preserving the history of that culture at that moment.
It's true to say that the people in the photographs have died, that many of the buildings are gone, that the signs are not there. But when you say it's who I was and it's who I am, I wonder if that's also true about the South. In other words, these pictures to me are still pictures one can find on the byways of the roads of the South. Do you think that that's true, that yes, things have changed, but there's something underlying that's also very much the same?
Well, the French love to say, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The more things change, the more they stay the same. And that is definitely true in the South. William Faulkner once remarked that in the South, the past is never dead. It's not even past. And these hand-painted signs along the roadways, get right with God, and advertising for fish and nightclubs, the lizard lounge doors. Those may be gone, but there are others like them that are across the landscape. And the quilt makers, the storytellers, the little houses with rusted chairs on the front porch, those will never change. It may be a different set of chairs, a different reading on the signs, but you feel like you're back home when you see that kind of world. There's something emotional, unspoken, when you drive by these worlds or when you stop and go in a little store and you see people sitting on the front porch talking. You've been there before, and your parents and grandparents would recognize that. It's an enduring, essential ingredient in what it means to be a Southerner or from the South. You never forget that. It's always part of your heart.
Now, lest we provincialize the region too quickly, one section of photographs in the South in color is called Roads Traveled. And there's no more famous road that you have traveled than Highway 61, the road through the Delta and its folkways from Chicago down to the Gulf of Mexico, with its most important stretch being the key avenue of the blues from Vicksburg to Memphis and back again. I often tell visitors who come to Memphis that this is one of the most important cultural capitals in world history. And I have my reasons for saying this. As one of the great scholars of this stretch of road, reflect for us in closing on what you believe this artery of the Mississippi has contributed to world civilizations.
Southerners are deeply in love with what Eudora Welty calls the sense of place. When they meet another person, they immediately ask, "Where are you from?" And once you know that, "Oh, you're from New Orleans, you're from Nashville, you're from Memphis. Well, come on in. I've known some strange people from Memphis before, and you are welcome in my home." Well, the sense of place of Highway 61 is an iconic place that is globally known today. It's the literal blacktop highway that runs from New Orleans to Chicago, but it's also that spiritual journey that the blues singers made as they fled the Delta, Muddy Waters, B.B. King, looking for a freedom, looking for opportunities, and they sang about that. "I walked Highway 61. Till I give down in my knees, trying to find somebody to give my poor heart ease." The highway was for the 20th century Mississippi Delta Black what the North Star was for slaves when they sang, "Follow the drinking gourd, follow that North Star out of the South." And the music they sang about it became more than just a blues anthem. It became an international anthem. Singers from the Rolling Stones around the world understand the power of the blues and the power of Highway 61 as a way to make the journey to freedom. So what today, when we return to Mississippi and we see the magnificent B.B. King Museum in Indianola, the Delta Blues Museum in Clarksdale, and the little museums in places like Leland, Mississippi, and the signs, the blues signs, they are our way of recognizing and saying to the international world, we will never forget Highway 61 and the families that made that journey.
Bill, before you leave us, just expand on that a little bit, sort of metaphorically. If we move a little bit beyond Highway 61, include in this reflection that we're closing with also some thoughts about the writers, the artists, the photographers that you've also focused a lot of attention on in the Storied South, beyond the blues musicians and their impact on music globally.
We can think of the Mississippi Delta and that Highway 61 world as a climate for genius, and within 100 miles or so of each other. At the same time, William Faulkner, Tennessee Williams, Elvis Presley, B.B. King, Jimmy Rogers, Eudora Welty, and many, many other writers, artists, musicians grew up and were shaped by that place, that sense of place that the South is so endowed with. So when we look at this trilogy, it's an attempt to unlock the rich heritage of all of these worlds and of the people who have shared them with us so generously.
William Ferris, thanks so much for being with us today on Counterpoint and for helping us to reflect anew on this place which is ours, on Southern culture, through this trilogy of books from UNC Press.
Thank you, Jonathan. It's an honor to be on your program.
William Ferris will be in Memphis on October 8th at 6 p.m. at the Cotton Museum, talking about and signing The South in Color. Don't miss this opportunity to hear one of the great scholars of Southern culture when he comes to town. Putting a spotlight on the role of scholars, academics, and intellectuals, and how their work illuminates the issues we face locally and globally, Counterpoint is a monthly broadcast on WKNO-FM. To listen to this show in its entirety, visit WKNOFM.org and click on the news menu item where you'll find a link to Counterpoint. Counterpoint is a production of WKNO-FM in association with the Spence L. Wilson Chair in Humanities at Rhodes College. Justin Willingham produces the show. I'm Jonathan Judakin. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.